Good to see everybody this morning. I need a volunteer this morning. Somebody that if you just raise your hand, somebody that's willing to help me out with a couple of things this morning. Yeah, that's what I figured. You know, I don't have a whole lot more detail than that, but you just hold on, okay, Jackson? You know, how many of us, actually, I just look out at all of you this morning, except for Jackson. He was afraid nobody would volunteer, really. You see, how many times in life are we hesitant about when someone asks for a volunteer, we're hesitant to say we'll do it unless we have a clear indication of what will be asked of them. And see, Jackson doesn't know what I might ask him to do in a few minutes. Now, On the other hand, many of us, if somebody were to ask us, do you want to do something great for God? Many of us would say, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do something great. Let's do something big for God. Now, I think that we all kind of fall into this same category. And I think that like many, once I may have had my desire to do something great for God stifled by my fear of what he might ask of me. I'm not sure what that case would have been. I can probably come up with some, but I'm not sure that right off the top of my head I can come up with those. But in hindsight, I can see clearly that I did. You know, it came from a time when I said, yeah, I'll gladly serve God. I'll just never be a preacher. I learned a long time ago, you don't tell God no. For others, I've heard others say, well, I'll go anywhere, God, but not there. And you can just begin to fill in and imagine those locations. Unfortunately, I sometimes find myself and I'm at it again. And I know this, I know that I'm not alone. I know that we all sometimes fall into this category where we think, I want to do something big for God, but not that. I started with a sense of this as I began to study for this sermon series. Actually, last year when I started to study for a sermon series that we did, Life on Mission, I really started to sense this, but I noticed it a little bit more as I started studying for this sermon series, the Love Where You Are sermon series. And at the same time, as I was beginning to think about these sermons and starting to put them in my mind and let them germinate there, I happened to hear a similar sermon series from a church in Lexington, Kentucky, and they were doing one. Theirs was also called Love Where You Are. I don't think they have anything to do with each other except for the names are the same. But it started to just sink in. And then it really caught me, you know, caught me by my shirt and just got all up in my face a couple of weeks ago when I was sitting in worship with the youth at CIY. But I'll mention that later. You see, Jesus had a unique way of doing ministry. If you study the life and the ministry of Jesus, you find that he had a unique way of doing things. Everywhere he went, everywhere he walked, he had a purpose. There was a purpose and an intent behind the things that Jesus was doing. Now, I'm not saying that all of his purposeful movements were unique. Rather, what was unique was where some of those destinations were. You see, one time we find Jesus making a trip across the Sea of Galilee to go to a graveyard to heal a demonic. Another time we find Jesus, instead of taking the normal route to go from Jerusalem to Galilee, Jesus instead goes right through the middle of Samaria so he can come to Sychar and meet a woman at the well. You see, Jesus went places that most people didn't go to be where he was. I heard one preacher say this about Jesus. He said Jesus didn't have an out-of-the-way mentality. He had an along-the-way attitude. You see, when we see Jesus, he's purposely going someplace, and it's always on purpose. But as he's going, he always had time to stop along the way and to meet the needs of those he met. So we see him going to heal Jairus' daughter, and we see him healing a woman who's had an issue of bleeding for 12 years. And he doesn't just heal her. He takes time to give her some encouragement, to give her some worth that she'd been missing. Jesus stops along the way. And you see, this is what we're called to do. We're called to have an along the way attitude. It's what we see in Luke chapter 10. If you want to turn there this morning, we'll be in Luke chapter 10. And it gives an encounter of Jesus and a teacher of the law. And Jesus is going to do some teaching about the along the way attitude in this parable that he tells. We're going to start by looking at verses 25 through 29 this morning. And Luke records this. It says, "And a lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' And he said to him, 'What is written in the law? How does it read to you?' And he said, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself.' And he said to him, 'You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live.' But wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?'" You see, here we have a Jewish expert in the law asking Jesus a question. I think it's the kind of question that we might ask. "God, I'm willing to serve you. Where are you going to ask me to go? God, I'm willing to serve you. What would you have me do?" And Luke records that this expert wanted to justify himself. You see, he wasn't just asking the question. He was trying to show how good he was. He was looking at himself, and he was sure that he had loved his neighbor. You see, he would have said that his neighbor were other experts in the law like him. The guys in his Torah study group. Or maybe it was the people who lived on Stuck Up Drive next to him. It was people who looked like him with struggles like his. People he liked and who liked him. When he was asking Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" this is who he expected Jesus to say. "Well, it's good Jewish teachers of the law, sir. Those are your neighbors." And to a point, Jesus includes those people in the group of people that he's going to say are your neighbors. But that is an incomplete answer. In fact, if we read Jesus' answer correctly, he really doesn't answer the question at all. Even in his own question, Jesus does not answer the question. But before we get there, let's look at Jesus' answer in the form of a story. Jesus replied and said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers, and they stripped him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. And by chance a priest was going down on that road, and he saw him and passed by on the other side. Likewise a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan who was on a journey came to him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion. And he came to him, and he bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them, and he put him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day he took out 2 denarii, and gave them to the innkeeper, and said, 'Take care of him. Whatever more you spend, when I return, I will repay you.' Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands?" And he said, "The one who showed mercy toward him." Then Jesus said to him, "Go and do the same." You see, the teacher of the law was probably expecting Jesus to answer the question, who is my neighbor? And I suppose if Jesus had done that, it would have been a much different answer. For any of us can identify who our neighbors are. They're people who live in close proximity to us. You know, that's why I've asked you for names. I know Laura, Chris, Dean, Darlene, Nanette, Kenny, and Sutton. You see, the horse guy and the flower people. Now, I'm working on some of the names, trust me. But those are my neighbors. Those are the people who live in physical close proximity to me. But it doesn't mean that I am their neighbors, according to Jesus' answer. First, I want to examine how we are neighbors, and then consider the cost of being a neighbor. Because these are the things that Jesus tells this teacher of the law. You see, Jesus turns this teacher's head into a pretzel. At first, the priest should have stopped and helped his fellow man. That's what a priest should have done. Second, if the priest for some reason couldn't, the Levite definitely. The Levite should have stopped and helped the man. And here's the thing, we want to judge these men, but I'm not sure we can. Because we don't know. Jesus never says exactly why they didn't stop. They just didn't. Finally, the enemy becomes the hero of the story. A Samaritan was not likely to have helped to stop a Jew along the side of the road, nor a Jew a Samaritan. Yet this is exactly what Jesus is saying in his story happens. The Samaritan, the enemy, the guys that we just don't like because of who they are. Because of the way they talk, because of where they live, because they're Samaritans, we don't like them. This guy is the one who stops to help. And his point, Jesus' point in the way he says this is this: if your neighbors don't have to look like you, and they don't even have to be people that you like to be your neighbors. You see, our neighbors are people with needs that we have the ability to meet. Your neighbors are people who maybe they look like you, maybe they talk like you, but maybe they don't. Who have needs and we have the ability to meet them. That brings me to the second thing that I see in Jesus' parable. And that is being a disciple will mean that you have to cross some lines. You see, fences don't make good neighbors. I don't care what the old adage says. I don't care what media tries to portray. Fences don't make good neighbors. Fences isolate us from others. While being a neighbor includes the ability to know those around you. And yes, so you might have to cross a property line and start a conversation. You might have to cross some ethnic lines and learn to communicate with somebody who doesn't speak English well. You might have to have some conversations with people who don't vote like you do. You might have to get to know someone who lives in a way that you believe is wrong, and maybe even learn like them. You see, being a neighbor means that you have to be willing to cross the lines to see people for who they are. Third, being a neighbor is going to cost you something. You see, it doesn't come free. It isn't cheap. You see, here in the story, Jesus has this Samaritan, and the Samaritan takes his own oil and he takes his own wine. Maybe it was part of his mixeria value meal. Or at least part of his dinner. Or maybe it was something that he was taking to trade. Maybe this man was on a journey and he was going somewhere where his oil and his wine would be the things that he would use to sell to make his living. We don't know exactly what this oil and this wine were, but they were this Samaritan's. And he uses them. He takes his own resources and he uses them to clean up the injuries of this this man that has been beaten by the robbers. And he uses them to clean him up and then to protect him from further harm. He uses them to help to heal this neighbor. Then he goes and he gets a room at an inn and he takes care of this guy overnight and he pays the wages, or he pays for the room, and then he gives the innkeeper 2 denarii and he says, here you go. If this man needs anything more than what it costs, what I've already paid, I will be coming back and I will make up the difference. And so this, he gives the innkeeper 2 days of wages. And he didn't have to. But yet that's what a neighbor does. Being a true neighbor might not cost you anything today. But there might come a day when it costs you gas to give a friend a ride. It might cost you time to scoop a driveway when it snows. It might cost you a cup of sugar. It might just be paying enough attention to the routine to notice your neighbor is gone and somebody's breaking into their house. I don't know, but what I know is being a neighbor, being a real true neighbor is going to cost you something. Because here's what I know, all relationships are costly. Fourth, you might have to get dirty. You might have to get dirty. You see, the Samaritan here, he had to get dirty to clean the man up. You don't help somebody who's been beaten and left for dead without getting dirty. He had to get it dirty when he started to clean him up. Then he had to get dirty when he bent over and he put this man on his donkey. He put this man on his ride. He had to get dirty. And then he had to get dirtier yet when he got to the inn and he had to take him off of his donkey. And he had to get dirtier yet when he took him into the inn and he finished the job of taking care of him. Now, being a neighbor very possibly means that there are, at some point in time you'll have to get physically dirty. But it's not always just about getting physically dirty, though. Sometimes it might mean that you have to get socially dirty. It's unfortunate, but too often we as followers of Christ forget that people in the world don't live by the same standards that we do. And when we reach out to them, other Christians will look at us and say, "What are you doing? They're dirty." And socially it begins with the body of Christ to have an impact when we become a real neighbor to people around us. Or our society as a whole may look at us and not accept others for whom we feel the call to be neighborly. And they too will look down on us. And you see, this is what's happening in Jesus' parable. It's not just that he was getting physically dirty, but Jesus is making a point to the teacher of the law about the fact that following God and doing what God asks us to do and being a neighbor means that probably there will be times when we get socially dirty. I mean, after all, it is the Samaritan who wouldn't have stopped to help a Jew if he had to. It was the Samaritan who stopped and helped this man lying on the side of the road. It wasn't the priest. It wasn't the Levite who the teacher of the law would have said, "Yeah, those are the heroes of the..." They're not the hero of the story? Jesus, what are you doing? This story doesn't make sense. The Samaritan was taking a chance that his friends and his neighbors from back in Samaria would hear about what he did for a Jew. And he would be despised by his own people. The Samaritan was already in a territory, in an area where he would have been despised, and yet he stopped. And we ask the question, why? Well, it's because being a neighbor, Jesus says, being a neighbor means that we take a chance of getting socially dirty by helping the insufferable. The Samaritan stopped and took the chance of getting socially dirty by helping the insufferable Jew. And so now I go back to my question. Not the question for help, but the question from the beginning of my sermon. How many of us want to do something great for God? Well, here's the kicker. Many of us would say that we want to do something great for God. We might even add a list. Unfortunately, we might add a list of our own boundaries. You know, God, I'll serve you anywhere. Just don't ask me to go to Sierra Leone. God, I will go wherever you want. Just don't send me someplace dangerous. God, I'll serve you however you want. I just don't ask me to work with little kids, because they bite and they run around. And God, I'll do anything you want. Just don't make it dangerous. Don't make it dirty, and just make it fun. God, I just want to have fun. I'll serve you anywhere as long as it's fun. Not hard work, not have fun. But when we look at the story that Jesus says, he says that if we're going to serve God, it's going to be difficult, and we're probably going to get dirty, and sometimes we're going to have to go places that we don't like. And we start to list our boundaries, and God says, no, if you're going to serve me. Well, we were at CIY and we were sitting there. We were studying Ephesians, and one of the speakers got up and he began to talk about the fact that in Ephesians, Paul is talking about sending church. Sending the church for mission. And sending the church to do great things for God. And then the kicker came. Because he says, if you read what Paul writes and you look about the fact that God is sending people, this is where he sends us. He sends husbands home to love their wives, and wives home to serve their husbands. He sends children home to love and honor their parents. He sends parents home to raise their children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. He sends slaves back to their masters to work diligently, and he sends masters home to treat their slaves with respect. You see, Jesus says, love your neighbor. And yes, your neighbors might be the people who live next door to you, who look like you and sound like you, and who you maybe even like. In fact, your neighbors at times may be the people who live under your own roof. But here's what Paul says. Paul says, if you want to do great things for God, the place to start is under your own roof. It's in your neighborhood with your neighbors. If you want to do great things for God, it starts at the job that you already have. It starts where you are. Not where you could go, not who you could be. It starts with who you are and where you are. And Jesus looks at this teacher of the law, and he never answers his question. Instead, Jesus asks another question. He says, who proved to be a neighbor? Who proved to be a neighbor? It's not who is your neighbor, it's who are you being a neighbor to? And this poor teacher of the law would have liked to have answered anything else. In fact, he cannot bring himself to say it. He cannot bring himself to say, well, it was the Samaritan. It was the Samaritan. This poor teacher of the law looked at Jesus, and all he could say, it was the one who showed mercy. Who is your neighbor? The one who needs your mercy. It's the one who has something going on in their life, that you have the ability to meet their need. Will you be a neighbor? You see, if we're going to love where we are, if we're really going to have the impact for the world that God calls us to have, it starts in your neighborhood. It starts with people who are closest to you. And maybe someday God will say, you know what? You've been faithful where I've planted you. Now you're ready to go to Sierra Leone or somewhere else. But it starts with faithfully serving where you are. Love where you are. This morning we're going to sing a hymn of invitation, and if you don't know Jesus as your Savior, we would invite you to come, and we'd love to begin to talk with you and discuss what that looks like. Maybe you just happen to be in the place where you understand that and you're ready to make that commitment. And we'd love to celebrate that with you in the waters of baptism this morning. Or maybe this morning life is just difficult and you need a neighbor. You need somebody that would stand beside you and pray for you. And if that's you, I'd love to welcome you to come up as well. And either I'll pray with you or one of the elders will come and we'll pray with you this morning. If you need to make a commitment, if you need to make a decision this morning, or maybe simply this morning you need to say, well, I've been attending here for a while and I need to make this my church home. We'd love to visit with you about that as well. Won't you come as we stand to sing Amazing Grace?